This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kimarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday the 17th of September. At least 9 people have been killed and nearly 3,000 injured by exploding pagers in Lebanon in a major attack on the Iranian-backed militia Hezbollah. We will hear from Lebanon's health minister and assess what impact this unprecedented attack might have on the region. Also, the rapper Sean Diddy Combs pleads not guilty to sex trafficking charges. We get the latest from New York. Should Oxford Street be pedestrianised? And for a late night look at the state of the US economy, the World Tonight's James Menendez has been taking a deep dive into the craft beer business in Portland. You're listening to The World Tonight with James Kimarasamy. This time the attack did not come from the sky, but from the victims' own pockets and belts on handheld devices that predate the smartphone age. Ambulances race through the streets of Beirut and other parts of Lebanon today as hundreds of pagers blew up with deadly effect in what appears to be a coordinated attack on members of the Iran-backed militia Hezbollah. According to the latest official figures from the Lebanese authorities, 9 people have been killed and nearly 3,000 injured. 200 or so are in a critical condition. Iran's ambassador to Lebanon is reportedly among the injured. Captured on CCTV, the image and the rather distressing sound of a man crying out in pain after one device detonated in a market. Well, no one is claiming responsibility for an attack that reads like a film plot, but which could have major real-world consequences. Israel and Hezbollah have been launching rockets at each other across the Israeli-Lebanese border ever since the October the 7th attacks. And in recent days, Israel has signalled it intends to step up its military campaign against Hezbollah. Earlier today, the Israeli Security Cabinet updated its war objectives to include returning to their homes the residents of northern Israel displaced by the fighting of the past 11 months. And yesterday, Israel's defence minister said the best way to do that was by military action. The BBC's Paul Adams is in Jerusalem, and I asked him whether the region had seen anything like this before.
No, I don't think we have. I think this is utterly unprecedented. I mean, you think of things like the assassination of the Hamas bomb maker Yahya Ayash back in 1996. Well, that was one man on a mobile phone which had a bomb planted in it and was triggered remotely. This is hundreds and hundreds of individuals with their pagers, all of which have somehow been tampered, all of which, it seems, had explosives planted inside them. Apparently, they may have been part of a new batch of pagers used by members of Hezbollah. It's worth pointing out that partly as a result of the Yahya Ayash experience, but also partly because of the trackability of mobile phones, Hezbollah don't use them, and that's why they've resorted to the slightly older technology of pagers, thinking that that is a more secure way of conveying messages across the organisation.
Israel never claims anything of this nature, but this is coming just as the Israeli government is ratcheting up the rhetoric when it comes to its northern border and what it intends to do to return Israelis who've been displaced since October the 7th.
Exactly. You're right, they're not going to claim it. But this does come at a time when when the government here is increasingly fed up with the situation along the northern border, which has existed now for almost a year since the start of the war in Gaza, with tit-for-tat exchanges across that border, which have claimed the lives of Israeli civilians, have forced tens of thousands of Israelis to stay away from their homes along the northern border. And so we have heard repeated warnings in recent days that Israel is considering purely military means to resolve this this ongoing situation at a time when the Americans are still trying to mediate some kind of settlement. So it does seem, you know, beyond doubt that Israel carried out this operation. The question is this a prelude to something, or is this it? I mean, if the effect of this will be dramatic, not only have you got hundreds, perhaps thousands of wounded Hezbollah fighters, some of them with really, really dreadful injuries, but it also, of course, is going to have a massively disrupting effect on their communications network and, frankly, on their morale, because this is a monstrous security breach. And so you could say this would be an ideal time for Israel to take advantage and press home the advantage and launch some kind of major operation in southern Lebanon. We're seeing no evidence of preparations for such an operation, and you would see evidence of that. It would involve, you know, the massing of troops and armor along the border. So it may be that that this operation is designed as a huge deterrent message to Hezbollah to back off and to lower the temperature along the border.
The BBC's Paul Adams in Jerusalem. Well, earlier this evening, I got an update on the situation in Lebanon from Firaz Abyed, the Lebanese health minister.
The situation is still dynamic, but up till now, we've recorded almost 2,800 casualties. 200 out of them are in critical conditions, either undergoing operations or have been transferred to the ITU. And we've also, up till now, reported 9 deaths, including an 8-year-old child. The people who came in large numbers, were reporting that they had a communication device, like a pager, that went off, you know, it started beeping, and then it exploded. And a lot of the injuries are toward, you know, in the face, especially the eyes. We have also injuries to the hand, with some amputations, and also to the flank.
Can the system in Lebanon cope with this?
Well, you know, this is a very difficult question. And you know, the health sector in Lebanon, health system in Lebanon has gone through a lot with the financial crisis, the Beirut explosion, COVID, and so on. We are trying to prepare the system as much as we can. That's why we have been holding drills, disaster plans, you know, coordination. And I must say that the response today by almost 100 hospitals around more than 14 emergency transport services, you know, we're able to absorb this quite large number of casualties. But you always are worried that if there is any further escalation or there is a full-out blown war, that, you know, things can become very difficult.
Do you think this is a start of a full-blown war?
I mean, it's
war?
Definitely a move in the wrong direction. I think it's a clear escalation. And we're into a situation that's already, you know, was pretty tense. And I think that, you know, a lot of people will be sleeping more worried tonight.
It is quite a security breach for your country, isn't it? For your government.
As I said, it is definitely a step in the wrong direction, and it's a clear escalation.
You do not have the ability, though, do you, to influence what Hezbollah does? I mean, clearly this is aimed at Hezbollah. Hezbollah has been sending rockets across Lebanon's southern border since October the 7th. Do you feel in a position to influence the situation in any way?
There has been sort of rockets flowing in both directions on the southern borders. And that's why the position of the Lebanese government from day one has been that Lebanon does not want war, and that, you know, we have called for a ceasefire from Gaza to Lebanon. And I think that there is more or less the majority globally are in agreement with that position, that, you know, it's about time to have a ceasefire.
Just on the method that has been used, I mean, no one can remember anything like this before. Have you seen any attack of this nature before?
I think that the nature of war is changing. I mean, it's clearly, whether you see it in Lebanon or you see it in Ukraine or others, it's clearly that there are new technologies that are coming in, there are new boundaries, a lot of the international humanitarian laws are being trespassed and so on. And you know, from a health worker perspective, I feel that not only Lebanon or the region, but the whole world is moving into darker times.
That was Lebanon's health minister, Firas Abiad. Well, neither the IDF nor the Israeli government have commented on this mass attack. But for an Israeli perspective, I've been speaking to Sarit Zahavi. She is the founder of ALMA. It's a research centre which specialises in Israel's security challenges on its northern border, where she herself lives. She was also in military intelligence for the Israel Defence Forces for 15 years. So what does she think the goal of this operation was?
I believe that the goal was, one is to create confusion with a psychological level, very, very simple. It's overwhelming for Hezbollah, this kind of damage. The second is to create an operational damage, truly damage the capabilities of these military operatives to fight. And second, as I've said, it is intelligence infiltration. And I believe that if you combine all three of them, eventually the goal of, as was stated yesterday night by the Israeli government, is to bring the 60,000 Israelis back home, because we are under attack of Hezbollah every day. I'm part of that. I live in the north. And if after this incident, there is the slightest chance that Hezbollah will agree to a diplomatic arrangement and to disarm, that's the goal, to disarm in South Lebanon, this would be fantastic. But I'm not sure that it will happen.
And the 60,000 of which you are one are the civilians who have been forced to leave since the war began.
I was not evacuated. I live in the range which is not evacuated, but suffer from the daily fire of Hezbollah anyway.
You're saying no one knows exactly who did it, and certainly the Israeli authorities do not claim these kind of operations. But yesterday, as you said, they made that statement that this was a war goal to return those civilians who have had to leave northern Israel. People will draw their own conclusions, I guess.
You said that.
In terms of what this means, though, for the broader military operation, clearly this is an escalation in terms of the attack on Hezbollah. It does make any kind of diplomatic solution less likely, doesn't it?
What diplomatic solutions? Hezbollah is refusing to negotiate a diplomatic solution. And we've been waiting for the diplomatic solution from 2006 to be implemented in the past 18 years, and it didn't happen. I want to clarify something, not only as a person who live up north, but also as an Israeli. All of us have the people that we dear and our closest relatives are soldiers in the army. And we fought in Lebanon for many years. We didn't have any intention to go back there. And we don't have any willingness to fight in Lebanon again. We don't have very good memories from that. But the situation that was created is that Hezbollah is attacking Israelis every day. This is an abnormal situation that I sent my daughter to school. And she knows that if there are the sirens, she have to go below the desks. And it's an abnormal situation that I can film from my balcony, the interception of the rockets. And I hear every day the hits of the rockets over here up north. And one of the rockets just missed me in 3 minutes on the main road here in the north on Thursday. So this should be end. And I think 11 months, there is no country in the world that would have waited for 11 months to protect its own people. So that's why I'm not using the word escalation, because I think it's not the question who is escalating. The question is, how are we going to protect our own people?
So you believe that this is going to make you safer, do you?
This incident for itself, the answer is no. There is no magic solution that one thing will be done and I will be safer. Clearly, no. There are a few things that should be done to make me safer. One of them is to be more offensive with Hezbollah that refused to disarm in South Lebanon in the past 18 years.
Sarit Zahavi, security specialist, former member of the Israel Defense Forces, speaking to me there from northern Israel.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And coming up later on, as the radio presenter Jamie Theakston thanks his attentive listeners for their warnings about his changing voice, we speak to a leading oncologist about the effects of throat cancer.
What happens with surgery, you get a bit of swelling around it, and that causes some disturbance of the voice. And that's why we advise patients just to relax, take it easy, don't use your voice, certainly don't go shouting at anybody, even your family.
More of that later on. Now, tomorrow, the chair of the Federal Reserve, the head of America's Central Bank, is expected to announce the first interest rate cut in the United States since the pandemic. Polling suggests the economy is the top issue for voters ahead of November's presidential election in the US. And prices have been rising sharply for several years, leaving many households and businesses struggling to stay afloat. Although the rate of inflation has been coming down, things are still tough. My World Tonight colleague James Menendez has been getting a micro view of that, a micro brewing view, in fact, by looking at the challenges facing Oregon's famous craft brewing industry. At least 30 of the state's 400 breweries have closed within the past year. And he began his report on a farm outside Portland, where the hops used to flavour many craft beers are harvested.
I'm Todd Cook, and I'm a hop grower here in the Willamette Valley in St. Paul, Oregon in the United States.
So tell us what we're looking at here.
We're in the last few days of our hop harvest, and yeah, all the vines from the field get brought into our picking facility, and then the hops all get stripped off of the vines themselves and the leaves also, and then those have to go through a whole process of getting separated.
And the smell is fantastic, that sort of perfume smell, isn't it? I mean, you're probably used to it now.
All you great craft beer lovers, you would love to be able to smell these hops when they come through the kiln for
it. It's that same aroma, isn't it? How is business at the moment for hop growers in Oregon?
Last year we were down like 12%, and this year we're down another 18%. So it's pretty drastic. There's a lot of fields sitting around that are idle. There's a lot of farmers in our local area that they're making that ultimate decision to switch over to a different crop.
And what do you put that down to?
I think mostly it's consumer preferences on their beverages.
I mean, craft beer has a reputation for being a little more expensive. I mean, it obviously costs more to produce. Is it also because drinkers are cutting back on their financial consumption, if you like? They want to spend less on their drinks?
We have some brewers come out from our local breweries in Portland area, and they come get fresh hops. And one of them was talking about they usually put like 7 or 8, maybe even 10 pounds of hops in a barrel, and they've cut it back. If they can make a six-pack for $14 instead of a six-pack for $20, it can sell more. But they're not using as many hops, so it comes down and hurts all the way back down to our little homegrown farms.
We hear a lot about inflation. I mean, it's obviously a big topic going into the election in November. How has that impacted your production costs?
All of our inputs have gone up. We need more people to drink more beer.
That doesn't sound too bad.
Well, yeah, it should be pretty easy. Everybody just go spend your dollars.
We are going into this election in November. I mean, do you have any idea, you know, which presidential candidate might be better for your business and better for the economy more widely? Is that something that you're thinking about now as we're
less than a couple of months away?
I don't think I'm going to go endorse somebody right now. I have somebody in mind, but...
Give us a clue.
I know things were rolling a few years ago, pretty good, the economy and such, and they're not so much at this time. So we're hoping whatever happens, it turns around.
That sounds to me like you want Donald Trump back in the White House, that you think the economy was better when he was in charge.
Well, I think with what I said there, that a few years ago we were rolling a little more in the economy, I think that probably answers the question.
Well, it's just a short drive from the hop fields back into the city, and one of Portland's many craft breweries. We're here at Lycum Brewery with Sonia Marie, who owns it. How's business for you?
We are in recovery from the pandemic. We're definitely seeing some shifts in how the consumer is treating beer, and we're on unstable ground, but moving forward.
We've been hearing that the demand from brewers for the hops is decreasing. In other words, you guys aren't needing so many hops. Why is that happening? Is that just because demand for craft beer is down?
Draft sales of beer are down significantly nationally. The consumer trends really are pointing towards other beverages taking precedence. And then we can't sort of disregard the impact that the cannabis industry has had on the consumer.
Well, they're smoking more and drinking less.
We are seeing that trend, yes.
And what about the economy more widely? Are people also just going out a bit less because people are feeling the pinch? They're having to tighten their belts a bit.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a factor. And I think what we've really observed is it's no longer coming to meet up with a friend and just sort of an after work drink on your way home. It's, oh, I'm going to Lycum for a comedy show or bingo.
Can you live off the money that you make from the brewery and the bar?
The answer is no. My husband Theo is employed by the brewery, although at a very reduced salary. And I spend part of my time working in the nonprofit sector to make ends meet.
And we hear a lot about inflation. Has that been hard to contend with? Presumably rising costs of energy, ingredients and so on. Has that been tough?
Very tough. Our electrical utilities have been up, what, 17% since the beginning of the year. It feels oftentimes like we will never be able to grow enough to make ends meet.
Is anything going to change after the election and who might be able to turn things around in the wider economy, if you like?
Yeah, I think that there is a recognition that the economy is a priority and that there needs to be a shift.
I mean, Donald Trump says he's the man to do that. Do you think he is?
I do not. He's not the best ally for my personal small business and the industry as a whole. I'll leave it at that.
Keep your vote secret.
My vote is not secret. Absolutely not. For all of its flaws that it may have, I absolutely will be voting for Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party.
And that was Sonia Marie from Lycum Brewing, ending that report by The World Tonight's James Menendez in Portland, Oregon. And a quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of this programme or to previous ones, you can always go to BBC Sounds, where you can also download the podcast. The main headlines so far on The World Tonight: 9 people have been killed and almost 3,000 injured when pagers used by members of Hezbollah simultaneously exploded in Lebanon. Puff Daddy, P. Diddy. He has gone by a number of different stage names during his successful career as a rapper and record producer, but today it was under his real name, Sean Combs, that one of the most influential figures in hip-hop history was charged with the most serious of crimes. The charges were announced a day after his arrest at Park Hyatt Hotel in Manhattan by U.S. Attorney Damian Williams.
The indictment alleges that Combs abused and exploited women and other people for years and in a variety of ways. As alleged, Combs used force, threats of force, and coercion to cause victims to engage in extended sexual performances with male commercial sex workers, some of whom he transported or caused to be transported over state lines.
Well, our North America reporter, Neda Taufik, joins us now from New York. Those are the bare charges, Neda. I mean, the details of what he's being charged with, pretty shocking.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the indictment goes through a number of details, as well as a document that was submitted by prosecutors to keep him in detention. It outlines how, from 2008 onward, he worked to lure women using intimidation into these so-called freak-offs, where he forced them into sexual encounters, allegedly, as prosecutors say, with male prostitutes that were transported over state lines. And they say that he then used his company and his staff as this criminal enterprise to keep these women silent. He would record these encounters and kind of use that to buy off these women, to keep these women silent, rather, and use his staff to trap them, to make sure that they couldn't come forward. And when anyone threatened to come forward, they say he engaged in kidnapping, arson, and all sorts of other intimidation tactics. So incredibly serious allegations in this 14-page indictment.
Yes, you just, I suppose, better remind listeners of who he is. I said, you know, one of the leading figures in sort of hip-hop history. I still can't say it, hip-hop history, but I mean, just what sort of figure he is, it is kind of immense, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, look, this is somebody who is one of the most influential producers in hip hop. I mean, he really cultivated artists like the Notorious B.I.G., the rapper, R&B singer Mary J. Blige. These are some of the biggest names in hip hop. And essentially, for generations, he really shaped their culture, their soundtrack of their lives. And just last year, he was so celebrated that he was handed by New York's mayor the key to the city. He was someone who was really credited with taking hip hop onto the global stage, as really making the genre very influential in pop culture and fashion. He himself, beyond the kind of Bad Boy Records, went on to own liquor companies, fashion lines, and really kind of set trends. So certainly somebody who many regarded as a father of hip hop, someone to look up to. But what prosecutors say is kind of behind that facade was an incredibly dangerous person.
He has pleaded not guilty to the charges, but he has been ordered to be detained.
That's right. Look, his lawyers had argued that he have home detention. They put forward a suggestion of a $50 million bond and said that the sexual activity outlined by prosecutors was all consensual. Even that by his former girlfriend and R&B singer Cassie, who, quite frankly, a lawsuit that she put forward earlier this year, which Diddy settled within a day, her allegations really mirror a lot of what is in this indictment. But nevertheless, prosecutors say that that was a 10-year relationship. It was consensual sexual activity. On the other side, rather, his lawyer said that. Prosecutors, however, said that he is someone who has been trying to tamper with witnesses, obstruct justice, that he is a flight risk. And so ultimately, the judge sided with prosecutors.
Neda, thanks very much. BBC's Neda Taufik there in New York. The radio and television presenter Jamie Theakston revealed today that he is being treated for laryngeal or throat cancer. The 53-year-old, who presents The Breakfast Show on Heart Radio, shared the news that he had had a lesion removed from his vocal cords and he would be resting those cords for a few weeks. He went to the doctors to get things checked out after listeners noticed a change in his voice. Well, I've been discussing his case with the leading cancer specialist, Professor Carol Sikora. First of all, how common is this type of cancer?
Laryngeal cancer, cancer of the voice box, occurs in about 3,000 people a year in the UK. So it's relatively common. It's usually in older people than our friend in the media. It normally happens when people are 60 or 70, that sort of age. But he's 53, according to the papers. So it's young and it's unusual. But interestingly, over the last 20 years, it is becoming commoner in younger people for reasons we don't understand.
And who is most at risk?
Everybody's at risk. It's just one of these things. Anybody can get laryngeal cancer. And it does start by giving a change in the voice. Some people get hoarseness, some people get a cough, some people cough up a little blood. But the great thing about this cancer is it comes to notice very quickly, usually before it spreads from the vocal cords, the cords that allow us to speak, to anywhere else in the body. And that's the difference between this cancer and many other cancers like lung or breast cancer, which can spread before they get detected.
And of course, if you are someone behind a microphone and people are listening to you, lots of people are listening to you, then you are more likely to get that symptom spotted, as was the case with Jamie Theakston. Perhaps we can just have a listen, just to compare really his voice from, first of all, October of last year. Let's have a listen.
Listen, before we say goodbye, because we're a little tight on time, we thought we would have a quick round of the Google game. So we've found some of the most common questions that your fans are typing in about you. Right. So what we'll do is we'll start asking the questions.
And let's have a listen to him from earlier this year.
Rebecca, you've just won
£30,000. Oh, yes! Oh, my gosh!
So I'm taken.
Have you met your friends yet?
No, they've just walked into the cafe and looked at me really strangely, thinking, what is going on?
Right, do you want to get them out? Get them out!
Would you have spotted something wrong from those two different voices that we heard there?
There is a difference. I think we all notice the difference there. And when you think what the cancer does, it's just a couple of millimeters, a tiny little thing, a nodule on one of the voice cords, the cords that allow us to speak. And that little distraction causes quite immense differences in the quality of the voice. So people notice it. And the main public health message is that if you have something like that, if your voice changes, if you have hoarseness and it lasts more than 2 or 3 weeks, you should do something. Obviously, he did something and has had a very successful operation, and probably that's all he's going to need.
You said everyone is at risk, essentially, but are there risk factors in particular?
Smokers, drinkers of spirits that like heavy spirits, whiskey, gin and so on, brandy, and people with bad teeth and so on have a slightly higher risk of laryngeal cancer. But everyone's at risk. And so doing something about symptoms and persisting in getting examination. He obviously persisted, got a voice box looked at with a laser-guided tube, and it's easy to spot. I mean, I used to run the head and neck clinic in West London. You could spot the patient as they came through the door. You could make the diagnosis in 5 minutes, and it's great treating such patients because they respond so well.
Right, and I suppose people would be wondering how easy it is to get seen to.
The problem in the NHS is getting into it. Once you're into it, the quality of care on the whole for this sort of disease is superb. And head and neck surgeons around the country do this type of operation that she's had routinely. It's low risk. It's high success outcome. Usually within 3 months, the voice becomes completely normal. The swelling, what happens with surgery, you get a bit of swelling around it, and that causes some disturbance of the voice. And that's why we advise patients just to relax, take it easy. Don't use your voice. Certainly don't go shouting at anybody, even your family. It's best not to say anything.
Advice there from leading cancer specialist, Professor Carol Sikora. The Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has relaunched his plan to ban traffic from Oxford Street. He's hoping to get new powers from the new government to override objections to his plans for pedestrianisation, which he believes will help to revive the street's retail fortunes. Well, Oxford Street is still a major shopping destination, but because of the internet, much less so than it used to be. Here's a poetic reminder of Christmas sales past.
Oxford Street, and light is dawning on a chill midwinter morning. From Wellin, Wapping, Wembley, Wales, they've come to do the winter sales. Some pass the time in useful knitting, while others just get tired of sitting. But from the moment when the door is opened, brother, this is war.
Well, I'm not sure about war, but there is certainly disagreement about the wisdom of making Oxford Street traffic free. These shoppers gave us their reaction to that possibility.
I think it's actually a really good idea. Frankly, it's over-congested, and also the cars aren't going anywhere far fast. Making people move to the outskirts will improve air pollution and overall bring people more to the businesses that are on Oxford Street.
I think anything that makes it easier for people to shop here is good, whether that's buses and cars or whether that's pedestrianisation.
If there are more people around, which would be more possible if there are fewer cars and more people are willing to spill out of open bars, that would be safer and better for women.
I don't know if the shops enjoy having pedestrian only. Cars tend to bring more shoppers from other areas of the city.
Cars and bars rhyming everywhere tonight. Some mixed reactions there. Well, joining us to discuss this, Peter Rees, former planning officer for the City of London. He's now professor at University College London's Bartlett School of Planning, and Barbara Stoll, who's director at the Clean Cities Campaign. Good evening to both of you.
Good evening, James.
Good evening.
Barbara, first of all, I think you are an advocate of a pedestrianised Oxford Street. Why is that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's great for business. It increases footfall. It boosts sales. You know, people spend more time in those shops once there's pedestrianization present. And, you know, we know that pedestrianization also reduces shop vacancies. Not only that, but it's great for health. It's great for well-being. You know, it reduces crime rates. And we have data for this, you know, from across the world where, you know, cities have already done similar projects.
Any city in particular?
Well, one recent example is Brussels, which has basically established now the world's largest pedestrian area, which is called the Pentagon. And it's an absolutely successful project with basically new shops, new restaurants, new businesses, you know, moving into the area. The whole, the quality of life for residents and businesses alike have, you know, increased massively. So it's, you know, we can only see the positives and hardly any negative impacts.
Peter, I don't think you're against this in principle, but I think you have questions about the wisdom of Oxford Street being a place that's pedestrianised.
That's right, James. I'm certainly not against pedestrianisation. It's been used widely, as Barbara said, you know, throughout the world. There are some streets that can be pedestrianised part of the time when you have street markets in them or busy times with pedestrians. My concern with a street like Oxford Street is it's not a place, it's the division between two places, Mayfair and Marylebone, two of London's villages, two of London's districts. If you take the what remains of the traffic, and there's only the buses and essential vehicles left in Oxford Street because cars were banned years ago, they have to go somewhere. They're going to be stuffed through Marylebone. Now, any sensible Londoner never walks along Oxford Street. They walk along one of the streets parallel to the north or south, and they leave Oxford Street for the tourists. I'm concerned about the damage is going to be to the surrounding areas of all the displacement of the activity that currently is in one of London's arteries, Oxford Street.
Well, Barbara, what do you say then to those knock-on effects that Peter's talking about?
Well, I think this measure can't just be looked at it, you know, by itself. There will be a package of measures that go alongside in order to make sure that the negative impacts are taken care of. And we have, again, very good examples internationally. So, for example, in Ghent, which is another Belgian city where pedestrianization was part of a larger scheme, they saw temporary traffic increase in the surrounding areas, but longer term, that traffic increase completely disappeared. And they also didn't see any air pollution levels increasing in the surrounding areas.
It's a lot smaller than London, though, Ghent, isn't it?
Well, certainly it is, but the area that they pedestrianised is quite large, and the Oxford Street and its area is very tiny compared to Ghent and this area. So you know, basically, longer term, there are many, many positive impacts, and every, you know, everybody's needs can be catered for when these plans are implemented thoughtfully.
Peter, what about the reason that the mayor has given for pedestrianisation, that regeneration, getting more people into shops? Do you have a better idea than pedestrianisation? What do you think would work better?
Well, indeed. I mean, first of all, I it never goes well when the strategic level of government starts interfering in localities, in neighbourhoods. Christopher Wren tried it after the Great Fire of London, and the LCC tried it after the Blitz with dual carriageways through the city. This is a local area with its own local authority, Westminster City Council. Good planning comes from the people and from the community, not imposed from above. You don't do planning to people, you do planning with people. Now, if you're looking at an area like Oxford Street, rather than spending a vast amount of money on boosting a politician's ego by giving him a ribbon to cut, after spending, you know, a couple of million pounds on paving and new benches and planters and all these sorts of things, what's really important in high streets up and down the country is finding uses for the buildings. Where there's underuse, where department stores have closed down, finding new shared start-up businesses, bringing education in so that you can have people being educated alongside the businesses that are going to be employing them. Bring the vitality back to the high street, but don't waste all the money on what I call tartification.
Right. There's a word for us here on The World Tonight. Barbara, I wonder if you want to respond to that.
Well, all I would say is that, you know, reviving local businesses, like pedestrianization, is one of the best ways to do that. Because, I mean, we have so much evidence to suggest that from across the world. And, you know, all of the concerns can be taken care of, you know, because this isn't just going to be a measure in and of itself. So there will be access. And in fact, it will give freedom back to the people. And even, you know, counterintuitively, people with disabilities will have more freedom to move around, you know, with the help of the Elizabeth line. And So basically, all examples show that, you know, there shouldn't be a reason why London cannot do this right.
The debate will continue. Barbara Stoll, Peter Rees, thank you both very much. Our closing headline tonight, at least 9 people have been killed and almost 3,000 injured when pagers used by Hezbollah exploded in Lebanon. And since we've been on air, it's been announced that the Princess of Wales has carried out her first work meeting since her chemotherapy treatment began earlier in the year. The meeting, related to the Princess's work on families and early childhood, was held at Windsor Castle. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone here on the programme, good night.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.